Today's incredible guest is Mr. Sam Han, who's a yoga teacher who first began teaching in 2017. Unfortunately, in 2021, Sam lost his older brother, Blake, who was a sniper in the Australian Army. And that changed Sam's life forever, which is kind of the topic of today's episode in how to deal and work through grief. Sam found it really challenging to return to his regular life, and he posted a lot about his grief journey on social media. And today he now works actively to show how vulnerability and role modeling healthy behaviors in person, online, through his yoga teaching and through who he is as a character can go an incredibly long way to a dialogue that enables us to work through hard stuff. And this is one of the rawest, realest episodes I've ever done in terms of holding space and being honored to be let into a guest's life whilst it's still being worked through in real time. Trigger warning in this episode, if you have lost someone, we go to some pretty beautifully rich, deep parts of his experience. But part of that might be confronting. So perhaps watch this episode when you're feeling like you're in a stable headspace or in company with someone that you trust. If you do get value from this episode, all I ask is one thing: please subscribe, rate, and review the show. It goes a long way to helping spread the message and allow more people to hear these productive mental health conversations. So without further ado, introducing Sam. Mr. Sam, as a built masculine man who I can already tell in the short space of time that we've chatted has an enormous heart, how do you balance those two parts of you?
I think I've never really had a problem with not feeling masculine. I've always been a super emotional person, so I've never felt the need to balance those two parts of myself. I've kind of always felt comfortable with them both just existing with each other, which does lend itself quite well to teaching yoga, I guess.
Yeah. Yoga's been an important practice for you to come back home to yourself and grow and work through some painful parts of your life. Is that right?
Very much so. Very much so. Yeah. I've been teaching for 6 years, practicing for around 8. And when I first started practicing, it wasn't like I was searching for anything. I was just at a stage in my life where I was happy to try anything. And I was at the gym one day and just walked past the studio that said there was a hot yoga class starting in 5 minutes. So I just went in, and it was a love affair that started from there.
What do you think it was?
To be honest, I think it was, at the very beginning, it was pure vanity. I was training for a competition. When I've told this story before, I call it a bodybuilding competition, but it wasn't an on-stage fake tan sort of ordeal. It was a 10-week challenge with the local supplement shop where you try to transform your body in 10 weeks. So at the time I was looking quite good, and there was mirrors in the studio, and it was hot and it was sweaty. I thought, oh, this is a good way to drop body fat, and it was fun. But if I'm to give you a deeper reason as to why I stayed, after those first couple of months where it was just purely physical, I soon started to realize that was the only part of my day that I was looking forward to. At that time, I was 23, and I was doing a TAFE course to eventually join the police, which I never really wanted to do. I think I was suggested to do this by family because I wasn't really doing anything with my life at that point. And the teacher throughout the practices would often, you know, they'd start to drop in those little drops of wisdom or give you the opportunity to think about things a little bit deeper. And it was during that practice that I realized that time in my life that I was depressed, and I didn't even know it. Like, the yoga practice taught me that I was depressed, which was such a really good realization, but scary as well, because I think I was just existing up until that point. And I'm sure you've spoken to hundreds of men who almost feel like it's just natural to not feel okay or not feel good, and just have that just get on with it sort of attitude. So that's why I think the yoga practice has been so important for me, because it's helped me to sort of, I guess, understand that it is okay not to be okay.
Mm.
And to give you a toolkit, essentially, to help you get through those points.
What's the reason you think a lot of men just exist in a state of lostness, directionlessness, and all the above?
I was thinking about this before the podcast as I was roaming around Bondi, and I don't know whether it's purely biological, or I sometimes feel that women may be innately more well equipped to deal with negative emotions in relation to themselves, whereas I know some men might see it as a weakness. Some men just, I feel, don't have the capacity to understand that that's what they're feeling, and it's easier to block out those thoughts and just live a more vague existence, almost ignoring what they're feeling. I think it's a combination of quite a lot of things.
When do you think for you the feelings first started that were probably not overly healthy? What age do you reckon you were?
As early as I can remember. Which, I try to unpack this quite often, but I think the internal dialogue I've always had surrounding myself has never really been positive. I've always spoke not very nice about myself.
What's the worst thing you've ever said to yourself?
I don't know about worst, but the most common is you're a piece of shit. I think I'm somewhere deep in my brain. It's just I know this is a completely wrong thought. I don't know, it's untrue, but I'm just sort of almost assume that I'm always going to be a failure and I'm always going to let people down. And that has just been the driving force for a very long time, up until I started practicing yoga, and it's still something I struggle with all the time. But it's so funny because I know it's untrue as well. Mm. Like, it's so untrue, but it's so strong, and it just keeps replaying and it keeps replaying. And you think you start practicing yoga and studying the texts and doing meditation and things like that, and I think from the outside looking in, sometimes people might think, haven't you got it figured out yet?
Mm.
And it's less about figuring it out, more about just trying to identify it. So at least you're aware that it's happening, and in those moments, try to stop yourself from having those thoughts.
I think a lot of people can relate, myself included, to this internal narrative of feeling like you're a failure, feeling like you're going to do something wrong. Is there a moment in your life where you first felt, can you think about a situation where you're like, I failed? What's the first time you think you failed?
I've thought about this quite often too. And the funny thing is, I can't really pinpoint any moments where I had failed to a degree. It's more so, I think one of my biggest fears is letting people down.
Mm.
And because of that, it often prevents me from doing a lot of things or trying my hardest and things like that. Like, I can rattle off a bunch of times where I was arrested, stole my sister's car and got caught drink driving when I was 17, didn't have my license. That was a bit of a failure.
Or a teenager.
Or a teenager. I remember the moment I had to call my mum to tell her. And I definitely felt like a failure at that point. I got expelled from school 1 month before the HSE.
Nice. That's impressive.
Yeah. I guess that's also a failure. But the reason I got expelled from school was not because of doing something. It was because of doing nothing. For the whole of year 12, I would turn up often without a school book and just hang out with my friends, just talk shit, go to the gym whilst I'm supposed to be in class. And the school actually, they tried really hard to keep me in school. They gave me keys to a gym that they had in the school hall, which no one was allowed access to. They gave me the key to that gym to try and coerce me to stay in school. But I was just a rat bag, you know. I guess I often try to avoid situations where there is a potential to disappoint people, you know, rather than studying for tests and things like that, I would just not do them because I know if I don't try, then I can't fail.
So it's not just the fear of failure, it's the fear of trying and then still not being able to achieve. So in some ways, to me, my initial reflections on that is there's also a sense of control under there, which is that if I put myself in a position of perceived control and I still don't control the outcome, that means that the world is chaos or bad things can happen. I am vulnerable and susceptible, and perhaps a protection mechanism that your beautiful inner psyche has built, which is that I can feel in control if I make myself believe that I never tried in the first place. Does that land at all?
For sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So it makes a lot of sense. And I think for us, once we unpack and get some awareness around some of this stuff, we can release a lot of the shame because, you know, I'm a failure is such a loaded thing. And if we, instead of trying to disown the part of us that believes that, invite them around the campfire and be like, tell me, where did you come from? What are you actually trying to protect? Because a lot of the time there's a positive seed under that thing. It just is showing itself in a really fucking strange way.
Yeah.
And again, I'm a pretty good judge of character. I would say just from the energy that I've seen from you since you've walked in the door, there is a very good heart under there. Maybe I just invite great guests and that's the common theme. But it sounds as if less you believe that you're inherently bad at stuff or bad as a character, but more that a perpetual fear of, letting people down and not being in control of that outcome.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is again, I know to be untrue because if I, in my daily interactions and in my work, like people do have very lovely things to say about me.
Mm.
And I'm sure you can relate to this, that another trait of mine is I'm really bad at accepting things. You know, like someone gives you a compliment, oh, no.
Mm.
Just that instant dismissal that you're not open to receive. Super happy to give, but not open to receiving.
Has yoga helped you receive? Because it's quite a heart-spaced focus practice where like you're literally trying to expand your chest to let in energy.
Yeah, it has. I think what I was in a teacher training just a couple of months ago, and the teacher was talking about their purpose or part of their purpose, and they shared what it was. So I went away and I really thought about what my purpose is or perhaps a piece of it. And I think it is to share.
Mm.
So, and that's to share everything, whether it be share a piece of content online or share music or share a conversation or share yoga. So I think when I am delivering yoga, I guess you could say, is when I feel the most comfortable, because that is me. I look at it as me giving rather than me receiving. I do absolutely receive the energy in the room and I do thrive off that. But it feels to me in the moment like it's more of a giving than it is a receiving.
Mm, that's true. You're sharing a lot of your energy, your wisdom, your knowledge. And I imagine you would describe yourself as a giver, someone who wants to be able to be there for others, support them, show up for them whilst perpetually fearing that you're not doing enough and sort of chasing your tail in this endless loop.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the main ways we got introduced is because we share a common friend who knows that you unfortunately lost your late brother, Blake, in 2021, and that has had a massive impact on you. And, you know, she said that she was so delighted and moved and inspired by your grieving process that she's like, you got to talk to Sam, like he's an incredible person. So first of all, are you comfortable journeying down this path a little bit to talk about Blake?
For sure.
What's your happiest memory with him? Yeah.
My happiest memory that I can think of was probably a year before he passed away, and I happened to be just driving past where he was living, and called him up and said, "Can I come stay at your house?" And he's like, "Yeah, sweet." And then I just remember we were in the garage just having a couple of beers, and I said, "Do you want to go for a walk?" And we just went down to the beach, and because my brother was in the army, he was a sniper in the army for 10 years, and he had left the army about 18 months before he passed away. And so we were just down laying on the sand, just looking up the stars, and it was it was such a good reminder of how different our lives were, because, you know, I was getting all sentimental looking up at the stars, and I was like, isn't this so beautiful, just looking up at the stars? But from his perception, 10 years in the army, you know, going out field month at a time, he's like, "I'm fucking overlooking at these things." It's like, it's all I did for 10 years of my life was be out bush looking up at the stars. But that was just a funny thing that I recall. But during that night, he shared some parts of himself with me, which he'd never done before, because there's this 6-year age difference, and we have another brother, Josh, in between, and an elder sister, Melissa, who's the oldest. But me and Blake were always far enough apart that we weren't at school together. But, you know, that right amount of distance where I was always looking up to him. Like, he was, even before he joined the army, he was always the most handsome, got all the girls. He was always a tough guy, always got into fights, which is something that I'll never be able to... Wait, I'll come back to that part. But, so I always looked up to him so much. And he was the kind of guy that nothing ever fazed him, you know? He was the strongest, he was the smartest, he was the bravest. He would tell you that.
Nice.
But that particular day when I went to stay with him, he told me that he'd overextended himself. He said, "I have to go visit a friend who's in hospital. Would you mind coming with me?" And I said, "Yeah, no worries." And I sat in the car. And 3 hours later, my brother came out. And I had no idea what was going on. And I was like, "Oh, what happened? Is your mate okay?" And he said, "Yeah, he's just under protective watch because he tried to kill himself last night." Which was heavy for me to hear, because I didn't know what was happening. And he said that Blake was the only person that his friend would speak to. He wouldn't speak to the doctors or the nurses or anyone like that, because they were in the army together. And they shared a bond. And after that, I asked him in the car, I was like, "Can I ask how you're doing in terms of, like, how's your mental health?" Which was so hard for me as a younger brother to even ask. And I just expected the response of, "Yeah, sweet, nothing." But his response was, "Well, seeing as you asked, I'm actually on antidepressants." And like I'm doing right now, immediately I just started breaking down. And he was like, "You're fucking crying for your pansy." And I think it was like a barrier had been lifted between us. You know, it was always younger brother, older brother, but his vulnerability to share in that moment was so special to me.
Yeah, I'll bet. It wasn't older, younger. We were just brothers in that moment.
Yeah.
And what did that represent for you? That your hero became your friend?
That for sure, but also that... And understanding that even the biggest, strongest men struggle as well.
Yeah.
And I think his ability to share in that moment showed me more strength than him getting in a fight with 4 guys at a pub would, you know what I mean? So I was super proud of him in that moment.
Yeah. I can hear and feel how proud you are of him, and it's so, so special that... And I'm sure he's looking down on us right now, and feeling honored that the bravest things he'd done, sniper in the army, and yet the thing you value about him most would be, I'm sure, the thing that he would want you to value about him most, which is that there was a tender human being under there that loved his little bro.
Yeah.
And from that moment, I guess you guys became even closer.
For sure.
And as that was a year and a half before he passed, the year leading up to his passing, you're enjoying this amazing relationship as you have your entire childhood, and then the ultimate news happens. What happens in the first 10 seconds after you hear the unhearable?
This I've shared with a couple of people, but this I'm interested to share this with you because it was my sister Melissa who called me, and I was getting ready to go teach a workshop, a yoga workshop, to maybe 40 people. It was an hour before that, and I'd just gotten out of the shower, and immediately I could tell by the tone of my sister's voice that something was wrong. And what was the most fucked up is that when she told me, I was looking at myself in the mirror because I'd just gotten out of the shower, and I physically saw and felt my face change, which even now, as weird as this sounds, when I see my own reflection, it reminds me that my brother's dead.
I felt that one.
You know, just, it was almost like physically feeling your heart sucked out whilst watching it happen. At the same time, so it was instant shock. I was pacing the house back and forth. I was talking to a friend who was coming to the workshop just by text message, and just out of shock I just called him and told him. He wasn't my closest friend, but I just picked up the phone and I just called him. And you know, even to this day, I have avoided talking to him because his voice reminds me of that moment. It's I can remember every single thing around my environment from that time, like etched into my brain, the colors, the smells, the sounds, everything. I'm so glad that I don't live in the place that when I found out the news. We moved out a month later, but yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah, wow. I've never ever thought about the difficulty of losing a DNA relative to the point where you see them in your own face, and the constant reminder of your own reflection that you've lost a kin, a blood of kin, you know. And that's something that's unavoidable. Like it's almost like the universe is forcing you to look at yourself and work through it and like not run away from that pain. But, you know, it's obviously still something that lives with you on a daily basis and has affected you deeply, understandably so. So you have this reaction, you hear this news, and then like your world is shaken up like a snow globe. How, and I say this not to relive your trauma, and as we spoke about before, and I just want to remind you again now, let's explore this carefully and safely, and if at any point you're like, I can't go there, then we back right off. And the intent of this pod and these conversations are always to relate to people who might be going through the same thing, to feel less alone. The next, let's say, 2 weeks, the snow globe is fucking everywhere. How are you? What are you holding on to?
I think the first 2 weeks were so full of things happening.
Practical stations.
Which, you know, I have to go. We had a funeral to plan. You know, we had to tell the family. You know, you've got people coming in and out of the house. So I think, first of all, that was a good distraction. And I think what had happened, whether I made this happen or it fell into place, but maybe because of what I do as a yoga teacher, I feel a little bit more comfortable conveying what I'm feeling, and I can help other people express something that they may not be able to express. So I kind of fell into the role of being there for other people, you know, being there for mum, being there for dad. My brother's wife and his 4 boys, you know, he has 4 kids. So I think,
wow,
that almost stunted my grief a little bit. because I was like, no, don't have time to think about it. I've got to go see this person. I've got to do this.
That on the shelf. I'll come back to that later.
Yeah. So that the first 2 weeks were filled up with that. I'll share something which I still find very interesting to this day. We sat down, had a family meeting about funeral proceedings and things like that, and, you know, what songs we're going to choose, what pictures we're going to show, all that sort of stuff. And immediately when the word eulogy was said, I was like, I'm doing it.
Stepping up.
I'm going to do it. Like,
yeah.
Fuck everyone else, I'm doing it. And in classic Sam fashion, I waited until the night before, until midnight, to write it.
Fear of letting your brother down on the eulogy.
Yeah. But also leaving things to the last minute.
Yeah.
But like I'm crying now during this conversation. I cried daily. And sure, I shed a few tears during giving that eulogy, but it was almost like Blake was helping me through it. And in that moment, I didn't feel sadness as much as I did pride. Pride that I was able to do that. So yeah, I guess the reason I bring that up is I found it interesting that, you know, I'm having a harder time now forming my sentences than I was then, when that was, you know, such a big moment.
The stages of grieving are so complex. So complex. You know, we build frameworks like the five stages of grief and things like that to try and understand, rationalize, and know if we're on track toward a path of one day living alongside of a painful moment such as a death. But it's certainly not a linear process. How would you describe in your own words the stage of grief that you're in at the moment?
Can you remind me of the five stages of grief?
Fuck, I should know this considering I have a master's degree in it. It's
denial,
shock, denial, anger. There's a weird word that comes next.
And then it's probably acceptance.
Yeah, eventually you get to acceptance.
I wonder what that weird word is. I'm probably there.
Negotiating, I think it is. Something like that, which is the... You're trying to integrate it and rationalize it. You're not necessarily angry, but you're trying to work out what life looks like now on the other side of that.
Yeah, I would say there. Like, if I was to even say the word acceptance, there's a part of me that, and you may have spoken to someone that may have mentioned this, but there is a small part of me that doesn't want to accept it.
Yeah, that's very normal.
Yeah. Because there's a part of me that enjoys feeling sad. And I don't want to let that part go.
Why do you enjoy feeling sad? It's common, but I want to know your why.
Okay. I think I try to rationalize things a lot, but you know Noelle from Rare, the yoga teacher? She was talking about her yoga students the other day, and she was saying there's a few different types of students that come to her classes. There's type A people, sensation junkies, and something else. And I was like, oh, fuck, I think I'm a bit of a sensation junkie. But the moment I found out Blake passed away and the pain that I felt, so whatever the biggest moment of your life is, whether it's, you know, getting married or having a child, and that's your happiest moment, whatever the biggest emotion you've ever felt, I feel that resets the baseline. And now anything that you feel in whatever respect is compared to that, the biggest thing that you felt.
Yep.
So I feel for myself often since Blake's passing, I find it harder to feel other stuff. I find it harder to feel as happy as I once was. I find it hard to enjoy things as I much was. I find it hard to feel sad about things, apart from Blake not being here, but other things don't make me feel as sad. So I think because the sensation was so big, I still want to identify with it a little bit. Because if I let that sensation go, then I'm worried.
You won't feel it all?
I won't feel it all.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's a reasonable fear to have. And I'm sure there's even more layers, like guilt of acceptance, like you're not allowed to let like go.
For sure.
Do you think, this is an existential question that's kind of just coming up for me at the moment, would you rather not feel at all or feel a lot of sadness?
I don't know if I could answer that question. I don't... probably feel sadness. At least it's something. Because, I've had those moments. Like, what anxiety feels like for me is when your mind and your body are not vibrating at the same frequency. Like, there's an imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when that vibration and you're in those anxious moments and it gets so rapid that it almost becomes like white noise, like something's moving so fast that it's not moving. Something happened the other day that I found really interesting. I was video recording, which I'm not a professional, so I'm still learning, in a room that has a lot of lights, fluorescent lights, LED lights and things like that. And there was a flickering when I was filming. And I didn't realize until after, and I watched some YouTube videos that, in Australia, the alternating current is 60 times a second that the current turns on and off. Our eyes don't see the lights turning on and off because our eyes are accustomed and are in tune with those lights. But if your camera's on a different setting, like one over 50 or 1/40, you can very visibly see that flickering light. Where was I going with this? I think when you're in those hyper anxious states, there is so much going on where it gets to a point where you just feel absolutely nothing. You're suspended in reality. You don't see time and space. You're just in a feeling of... I'd liken it to when you're coming down off MDMA, for example. I'm not sure if you can relate to that, but as a youngster going out and having party drugs and the next day you're so depleted of dopamine and serotonin and things like that you just feel fucking dead. I think that feeling something, for me personally in this moment, would be better than feeling nothing. Because at least if you feel something, you can work towards not feeling that way. Whereas if you feel nothing...
you got nothing to work with.
That's scary. It's a scary thought. That was a very long-winded answer, but...
No, incredible answer. I think your visual storytelling in order to communicate your emotions is exceptional. And I do relate to that analogy about, I know exactly what you mean with the flickering, and sometimes anxiety is so much, or a feeling is so much that it's gone to a frequency that it looks like it's always on, but it's actually not. It's ebbing and flowing so rapidly that it's almost, majestic and non-human. And what we're trying to do is get that vibration from mind, body and spirit in alignment so that we can feel harmoniously instead of like statically or erratically.
Yeah.
What do you think is the... in the pursuit of trying to get alignment with the event of Blake's passing, and I guess ultimately that's the goal, to integrate it, for the flickering to at least be pulsating at the same rate whereby you feel as if I can coexist with this pain and this reality, what's the hardest part that you're struggling to harmoniously live with?
One thing that I struggle with quite a lot is... there's four boys that lost their dad. A wife that lost their husband. Lost her husband. I think from a personal standpoint, what I struggle with is what really helps me when I'm feeling sad and I'm feeling this anxious state. What really helps me is doing physical things, whether it be running or going to the gym or practicing yoga. But innately, my constitution is to be lazy. Like, I'm a lazy person that masquerades and tries really hard to be an active person. But when I'm in those states, it's super easy for me to do nothing. So, you know, I sit at home and feel sorry for myself and eat bad food and then feel worse and have a beer and then feel worse again. Until it gets to a point where I hate myself so much that I have to get up and do something. And the conversation that it replays in my mind is like, you know, it doesn't have to get to this point for you to do something. Like, you could just get up in the morning and go for that run or go to the gym or practice yoga. You don't have to hate yourself all day and make, you know, layer upon layer of bad decision until it's like the fire under your bum is so strong that you need to get up. It's like, I know the work that I have to do. Sometimes I just choose not to do it. So I think your question was, what do I find the hardest thing about integrating? The hardest thing is the battle that I have with myself, because I know what work needs to be done. And, you know, from the outside looking in, it might look like I'm doing it, but I might be only doing it 30% of the time. So I think it just comes back to discipline.
Just tell me if this lands or feels true. Do you feel as if the way that you're approaching this grief and heading toward integration, you don't want to let Blake down by doing it incorrectly so that you delay doing it at all?
No, I don't know if I agree with that. I think... Okay. I don't think there's a way that Blake would be let down. Like, he would never give me a compliment or anything like that. But what I found super interesting is, because I always thought, you know, there was a little bit of me that thought, oh, my older brother hates me. And, you know, I always would try and do things to impress him growing up and try to be cooler than him. But it never worked. I always fell flat. But I remember... after his funeral at his wake, he had all his army brothers there who I hadn't met before. And a lot of them came up to me and said, oh, you're the yoga guy. And I was like, yeah, what do you mean? How did you know that? He's like, oh, when we were in Iraq, Blake would get out his phone and show us photos and videos of you doing handstands and show us your YouTube channel. And like, that to me in that moment, like, whether he said it or not, he must have been proud, right? He could have been showing them, saying, look at this fucking wiener.
But I got it, man.
So I know that I'm not letting him down. I know that. I think it just comes back to that sensation junkie thing. Sometimes I feel like the feeling of me hating myself is a bigger feeling than if I was to go for a run or do a hard workout. And I'll always default to whatever the biggest feeling is. I think I just had that realization out loud for the first time.
How does that feel as you say that? What does that represent or reveal to you?
That I don't know. I don't always have to go for the biggest. I should go for the one that serves me.
The truest, maybe. Maybe not the biggest, but maybe the truest. Because I don't actually believe you when you say you hate yourself, because I know that you see what other people see, which is a pretty good fucking dude.
Maybe hate's the wrong word. But,
dislike.
Yeah, yeah. I think what I need more than anything, but I would probably hate to admit it, is I need help.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the time because I haven't spoken to anyone before, like a psychologist or a therapist or anyone. And part of me is like, I don't need to, because I can do the work myself. Because I don't have a problem communicating, and I think I have a pretty good understanding of what I am feeling. But everyone needs help, so I think that's just an excuse for me not wanting to do it, because it's hard.
Yeah, this isn't the first time I've done this, so don't feel like I'm picking on you. But can you make a commitment to me on this pod that you'll book in to see a therapist?
Yes. We have to now. The world's seen. I'm sure there's a lot of people who will be happy that that just happened to you.
I think so, man. I think there's a lot of people that probably care about you that have seen this and just deeply want you to be happy or at very least at peace. And I can tell you right now who's the number one person that wants you to be at peace. You've just been speaking about him for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
What would he want you to do? He, regardless of how you get there, he's looking for one outcome for you.
Mm.
And sometimes with therapy, especially if we have a self-loathing internal narrative, again, one in which I can relate to, the best inspiration can be to do it for others.
Yeah.
You know, there's the psychology research even at the gym, which is if you set a goal for yourself, you're far less likely to stick to it than if you have to do it for someone else. Like if you don't come to the gym tomorrow, I'm going to donate $20 to Trump's campaign, you know? if you don't come tomorrow, we made a commitment, you're letting me down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what going to therapy represents right now, if you do, which I do believe that you will make that next step, is that you're showing everyone else that you want to help them. Yep. By looking after yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to frame it, because whenever I do anything, I always frame it in a way that I make it bigger than myself, sort of thing. Like, so after Blake did pass away, one of the first things I did with one of his mates was we ran 10 Ks a day for 30 days in a row during November.
Fucking hell.
So this is one of Blake's mates who's in the army. I'd only met him at Blake's funeral, and he lived up in Darwin. And he just reached out to me one day, and he's like, I really want to do this. And we're going to raise money for the Black Dog Institute.
Mm.
Because one of his friends had taken his own life. I'd only met this Blake's mate once, and I can't even think of his name right now. I can only think of his nickname. Tom. We'll call him Tom.
You and Tom. What that shows is that you would just have this absolute, it didn't matter about the details. You just had a big emotion.
Yeah.
And you were like, let's fucking go.
Let's fucking go. And that was fantastic. We ended up raising $7,500.
Congrats, brother. That's awesome.
And one day in the middle of the run, 10 Ks a day for 30 days for someone who's not a runner is
and you're
tough.
A big boy as well.
Big boy, like, it hurt.
Yeah.
On one of the days, it was Tom's friend who passed away. He said, oh, he would have been 27 on this day. Do you want to run 27 Ks on this day in amongst the 10 Ks a day for 30 days? Yep. No worries. It's it feels, again, it comes back to not wanting to let people down.
Mm.
Like if what I can do in some way is going to benefit someone else, then absolutely I'm going to do it. But if in the moment it's only going to benefit me, I'm more likely to not do it, because it's a lot easier to let myself down than it is to let other people down.
So is that why as we're framing it in that light, therapy feels more accessible, because it's a holistic thing versus a Sam thing?
Well, now that you've framed it in that way, for sure. Yeah. I think before, you know, I may have perceived it as just something that was going to help me.
Yeah.
I think one of the things too that, again, it could just be an excuse, but one of the things that I keep coming back to is it would be super hard to see a therapist, for example, and the connection wasn't there between you and the therapist, or it wasn't the person, or you shared all this information, and then you go out and you're like, fuck, I don't want to see that person again. Mm. Now I'm going to have to go do it again with someone else.
Retell the story.
Yeah. So because I've heard some people who even gave me advice that, oh, I had to go through 3 or 4 therapists. I'm like, shit, that's you?
Happens, bro. It does. And I think that the key there is just to know that you don't need to share everything up front until you have a match. Mm. Because what's a better scenario? You take a little bit longer with someone, you test vulnerable moments to see if there's connection instead of going top to bottom story. And also, it's totally fine, normal, and healthy when you're seeing a therapist to say, hey, one of my boundaries is just to like go slow as we start to figure out the relationship orientation. So even if they ask you, tell me why you're here, and you answer that probably not in the fullest extent straight away, there's nothing wrong with that. The worst thing that can happen is you either divulge so much, then figure out they're the wrong person, but you're like, oh, fuck, I got to stay here now. It's sunk cost, you know? And as we know with any law of economics, sunk cost isn't a good enough reason to do something.
Yeah.
Don't throw good money after bad, or don't keep an investment just because you're bleeding, so I'll just continue to bleed. It's like, no, we can take that out and redo. The other thing is that a bad experience doesn't mean a bad future experience. It's not evidence to the brain that you're too far gone, you're too broken, no one will ever understand me.
Yeah.
And I say in my talks, expecting to match chemistry-wise with your therapist on the first go, which does happen, by the way, is like marrying your childhood sweetheart, expecting that your high school girlfriend's going to be, because chemistry's hard to find. You're going to tell this therapist more things than you might have told people that you trust and have known for decades. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just correlated to postcode. Like that fit is more than just a practical thing. It's a vibration. There's a whole bunch of interpersonal communication things going on. And it's okay if you go and try on a few therapists. Like I'm a big fan of date your therapist.
Yeah.
Like go have a couple of dates with different ones. And then eventually you'll be like, whoa, I want to see that person again. Your body will tell you, I want to go back to that person and tell them more shit.
Yeah.
And so the way to reduce the barrier or the friction in between that dating stage of therapy is to give little bits so as not to sink all in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's good.
And I'd be happy to be a sounding board as you go through that process. But brother, don't give up if it doesn't come on the first go. I promise you, you'll find a match and it will change your life, guarantee.
I have no doubt.
Mm.
Just scary.
Yeah. You mentioned before that there was a moment of vulnerability between Blake and yourself, which really kind of removed any veil of power dynamics, and the hero became the peer. This is a tough one, but it's part of the healing. What's one thing that you wish you could tell him?
One thing that I did tell him in a message after he'd passed away. I write him messages all the time.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah. And share memes with him and stuff on Instagram.
That is so cool.
But in the days following, I mentioned to you the details of his passing prior to the podcast, which I want to make super clear was not suicide. I think a lot of people see young man in his 30s, army, was here one day, gone the next. A lot of people instantly assume suicide. My brother did not kill himself. One thing that I did tell him in the days afterwards is that I'm not angry at him. I know it was an accident. I'm not angry. And I don't want him to feel sad. Because I know he would.
He would be upset with himself. He'd be disappointed in himself that that was the outcome. Had he known that was going to be the outcome?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Do you think he can forgive himself?
I don't know. It was...
Do you think he could forgive himself? Sorry. Yeah.
I think wherever he is now, he has access to some people that could help him. You know,
some counselors there up in the sky, some family and friends to lean on.
He's got some tools up there that could really help him. I usually wear a necklace. I broke it recently, and it has Archangel Michael on it, who's the patron saint of servicemen, or what they call the leader of God's army. And I'm not particularly religious. I was raised Catholic, and my family are Catholic. But a family member who's very close to me, she does get messages, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And after Blake passed away, she pulled me aside and said, I have some things that I can share with you if you want to hear them. If it's going to cause you pain, absolutely not. And without going too much into it, one of the things was that Blake was with Archangel Michael now. And, you know, he's now helping other people in God's army, which, I mean, whether you're religious or not, that feels good to me.
Fuck yeah.
You know, so I hope he's forgiven himself.
Is there anything within yourself that you need to forgive you for in relation to Blake?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep. There was a lot of personal guilt after, whereas some conversations and some experiences that we had had with each other prior, where I thought, am I partly to blame for this course of action? Am I partly to blame for what happened? Which, again, I know is not true, but it's really hard. Could I have said something in the weeks before, or could I have...
It's very normal.
Yeah. It's just so tough, because after we had that night and we were looking up at the stars, and he was... You know, he told me he was on antidepressants and he had been seeing a psychologist, and I was really excited for the next stage of his life to not identify as the sniper in the army anymore. You know, I was just going through my messages with him prior to this podcast because I was like, I'm going to see if there's any gems in there. And 2 months before he passed away, he wrote a message and said, I just enrolled in TAFE. I'm going to study horticulture. He's like, I want to work towards, in the future, you know, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, and had a dream of, you know, having his own bar/restaurant where everything was farm to plate. And the message was, I want to do something that makes me happy, and I'm excited to study again. It's like I could see and feel in just his communications that he was making changes here, like in the mind, for himself and for his family. And, you know, one of the things that I need to forgive myself for, but I haven't, is he was making those conscious changes in himself, whereas I'm perhaps struggling to do the same for myself. And I do beat myself up for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if I look at Blake like the biggest, strongest guy, he saw a therapist. Why haven't I?
Mm.
I'm not the biggest, I'm not the strongest. If he can do it, surely I can.
And you will.
Yeah. I don't know if that answered the question or if I just went round in a circle.
No, you answered it perfectly. Your vulnerability is inspiring, to say the least. All right, so probably three questions.
Mm-hmm.
What's the number one piece of advice you would give to someone who's supporting someone like you through grief? Because a lot of people can clam up and not know how to interact, what to say and do. What do you crave of people around you during this time?
Normality. I'll share a good story, because my partner, for example, there was a lot of times where, you know, she wouldn't know what to say. And I can totally empathize with that, because had I been in her position, I wouldn't have known what to say either. I remember I had 3 or 4 weeks off teaching yoga after Blake passed away. And why that was so raw for me coming back is because, like I mentioned previously, I was on the way to go teach a workshop when I found out that Blake passed away. And, you know, one of my good friends, Amy, that I work with, she had to call everyone and let them know. So all the students knew exactly what happened. And just before I taught that first class coming back, I knew that everyone was going to come through the door, give me the puppy dog eyes, give me the sad look. And I was like, fuck, it's not what I need from 30 people right before I'm going to go and stand in front of them for an hour and be vulnerable. And there was one member, God bless him, his name's Jason Greenwood. He walked in, just smacked me on the back and says, "G'day, mate, glad to have you back." And just walked straight past me. And I was like, fuck, that is what I needed. There is nothing that you can say to someone who has lost someone. So don't try. Just be there for them. Just be there.
Don't try and fix it.
Don't try and fix it. Because whatever you're going to say in relation to that grief is going to make that person think about that grief. And when it's in those initial stages, what I really needed was something to take my mind off it.
Yeah, like distraction at the start, and then when you're ready, that's when you start asking questions that enables you to feel, process, and let go.
Yeah, but that distraction can still, like, for example, my two best friends, Jacob and Spencer, like, we spent a lot of time in that first week just talking shit, you know, having beers, hitting golf balls, and in that, what can be described as initial distraction, we started to share stories about Blake. And it became hilarious and fun whilst still being sad. So I think just make people feel normal in a time that they really don't feel normal.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, calling attention to it.
And there's probably different, well, I know that there's different, from a supporter psychology perspective, different ways to interact with someone experiencing grief depending on the stage that they're in. So, you know, right away, it is not trying to fix it, not trying to reassure them, make them feel better, being very normal, as you say. Then there's a process of, you know, deep listening and grieving and hearing and sitting in and with. And then there's a process of, you know, celebrating and remembering and story sharing, and they can all intertwine. But I think that the worst thing you can do is avoid someone like the plague and act really different and make it a huge thing. It's just lean in with confidence, either normally or sincerely, but don't back away with awkwardness, right?
Don't back away. Yeah, I think what helps so much is just being surrounded by people.
Yeah.
We have a really big family, lots and lots of cousins, and just having so many people around to share memories and to help out, like with things that you don't even think about. Like, you don't think about food. You don't think about cooking. You don't think about washing your clothes. Like, to have people around to help do those things. So that would be another piece of advice. Like, don't ask someone how you can help. Like, if you were to...
Just do it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah. And what is one thing that you would like someone to hear if they are going through grief right now?
This will sound silly because I don't take my own advice, but I would say talk to someone, but I don't mean that in go and talk to a professional immediately. One thing that helped me so much is I did share very vulnerable parts of my grief online. Like, on Instagram specifically. And part of that probably was because it helped me. It helped me. I like to write. I like to speak. But it helped me because from that, a lot of people shared similar stories. And a lot of people, you know, reached out and said, "Thank you so much for sharing. I'm going through the same thing, but I don't have the strength to share it." Which is why I found it so necessary to come on this podcast, because in my dry-mouthed, half-crying rambling, maybe there's something that someone can take away.
Absolutely.
But that's easy to say if you have a following on social media. If you have 3 followers, and nobody's probably going to see it, but I still think as somebody who knows how easy it is to just retreat and just be by myself, I always felt better when I was speaking to someone.
Amen. Brother, thank you so much. I think that's a really nice place to leave it. It's been truly special to share this moment with you and to be allowed in to share some of the moments you had with Blake. And I think for people experiencing grief, it would be incredibly therapeutic and cathartic to hear someone express this and almost have an opportunity, maybe as they're listening, to relive some of their memories. And if for whatever reason, whoever's listening to this, it has allowed you to go back and relive some of those memories, and that might have brought up some pain and tears, I think that that's okay. In fact, it's somewhat healing. You know, together right now, what we're doing is we're disinfecting that wound, we're honoring what was, and we're creating space to allow what can be.
Yeah.
What is the next chapter without them here in the physical world look like? Whilst always knowing that they're always here. Because at the start you said, when you looked in the mirror, you see him. And I think there's going to come a day where you look in the mirror, you see him and you smile, instead of looking in the mirror, seeing him and making you sad.
Yeah.
And I know that will happen, and I can't wait to check in with you and see what life is like when, you know, Blake and Sam have become one. Because it will happen. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, my man. Can I share something?
Please.
Really quick?
Yeah.
So, this tattoo I have on my hand of a rose. So the last time I saw Blake alive was at my grandmother's funeral. And me, Blake, and my other brother, Josh, we have this running unspoken joke where whenever we shake each other's hand, we try to fucking break each other's hand. And that last moment that I saw Blake, he had to go home, and we shook each other's hands, and I tried to break his hand, and he tried to break my hand, and he looked at me in the eyes and he said, "Oh, we're doing this, are we?" Like, it was such a small moment, but I still remember exactly where we were standing. This was 2 months before he passed away. Like, I don't remember the last time I saw the exact place I saw my mum or my dad, but I remember exactly where we were standing, exactly what he said to me. And we all got a rose that day for Nana's funeral. I had a rose in my left hand, and I was shaking him in my right hand. So now every time I shake someone's hand, I get to think of that moment.
Very, very cool. I might actually have to add one to me and steal your story, because that is fucking beautiful.
Yeah, it's cool.
And you're shaking, you're trying to break someone's hand out of love.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it reminds you that there's a lot of love to give.
Yeah.
Much love to you, brother. Thank you again.
Thank you, bro.